Somebody tell me what year of Jehoiakim's reign Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem?
Third year.
Tell me what year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign it was. It was actually prior to Nebuchadnezzar's actual reign. He was co-regent at the time with his father, but Nabucodonosor, his father, was still on the throne. It is from Jerusalem that he will return to Babylon to take control of the kingdom after his father dies. So it is actually, quote-unquote, his almost first year. Now, what year does Jeremiah say that it was What year does Jeremiah say of Jehoiakim's reign it was that Nebuchadnezzar came to Babylon? Daniel says it was the third year. What year does Jeremiah say? Fourth year. All right. Jeremiah says it was the fourth year of Jehoiakim's reign. Daniel says it was the third year. Okay. And we talked about last week that the difference is Daniel will consistently use the Babylonian method of counting the years of a king. And Jeremiah obviously will be using the Jewish method of counting the years of a king. Okay? In addition to that, what were some of the qualifications for the young men who were to be brought to Nebuchadnezzar from Jerusalem? Okay.
The opposite of Jonathan.
Right. Indeed. Such that they could learn the language and literature of the Chaldeans as well. All right. They were appointed a provision of food from where?
The king's table.
That would have been the best or the worst food in the land. The best. Who is it that refused to eat and drink the food from the king's table? Daniel and? Whose names are? Their Jewish names. Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. All right. They're called Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael in verse 6.
Oh, but verse 7?
Gives their Babylonian names. That is correct. I'll make a rule just for Eddie in this class. You can feel free to say Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego if you can tell me what the names mean. If you can tell me what the names mean in Babylonian, then you feel free. It is when you're the teacher. We'll find out it also is fair when you're the king. Chapter 2. Who made it possible for Daniel to find favor in the eyes of the chief of the eunuchs?
God.
All right. What did Daniel and Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael request of the chief of the eunuchs?
10 days.
All right. A 10-day trial of vegetables and water while the others were eating the king's food from the table. And the ultimate goal after the 10 days was to find out what?
They were as good as the other.
All right. Who looked better? All right. So I think, if I remember correctly, we got down to about verse 17. So the end of the test, the trial, was that Daniel, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael were those who looked better in form and appearance than the remainder of the individuals after that 10 days. Now, 10 in Jewish literature, the number 10, simply deals with a complete amount of time. This could be a literal 10 days, or, especially given the usage of numbers within the book of Daniel, it could, I'm not saying it is, could be simply Daniel saying, take a sufficient amount of time to judge which is the correct one. I tend to think that it's probably a literal 10 days because the context is fairly literal, but it certainly is possible in the greater view of the book that 10 could be just simply a complete amount of time there. Same as in Revelation chapter 2, verse 10, as a matter of fact. That's something else to look at. But the steward, verse 16, will take away their portion of the delicacies and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. So when it's shown by Daniel, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael that they're going to be, their way is better, then the remainder of everybody else loses their diet of meat and wine and they get vegetables and water. So everybody changed to a vegetarian diet at the king's table, at least those under the charge of the chief of the eunuchs. So verse 17, and as for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. So God blessed them providentially with knowledge and wisdom, and blessed Daniel miraculously with the understanding of visions and dreams. There's a difference there. It's not that Daniel didn't have wisdom and knowledge, but he had that and additionally understood visions and dreams. Now, the indication is, while this statement is here in chapter 1, there's not any indication that he had, as of this time, the ability to understand visions and dreams. Instead, that will be part of his ongoing life beginning in chapter 2. But it is mentioned here in regards to him just in describing the four individuals. Now, at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king interviewed them, and among them all was none found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king. Now, some have questioned, well, if they were found better than all the other wise men, why is it that when the king has the dream, he doesn't call them in with everybody else? In chapter 2. And so some possible solutions to that could be they were found better than all the wise men that were coming in as captives, but that didn't necessarily make them, in Nebuchadnezzar's eyes, superior to all the wise men that were currently there. Could be that. Could also, more likely, be just because you're shown to be wise, or shown to have understanding, shown to be able to speak wisely, doesn't mean you have the experience that others have. And so therefore, when this dream comes up in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar most likely calls the most experienced and the greatest of his wise men, and not the fresh out of school wise men. Yeah, that is what. So, verse 20. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. Again, the idea of 10 here, not necessarily literally 10 times in a calculable number, but they were completely and sufficiently better than all of the other magicians and astrologers who were in his realm. Thus, Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. Now, this statement has also been that which has been attacked by liberals who have supposed that it's a glaring mistake by the writer Daniel, since in 121 we are taught that he either died or finished prophesying in the first year of Cyrus, while in chapter 10, verse 1, he's very much alive and at work, which is the third year of Cyrus. It would be difficult indeed if that's what chapter 1, verse 21 taught us. That is, that he died after that point or finished prophesying. But it doesn't. It just simply says that he remained until. It's not a statement of when he ceased to prophesy or ceased to live. It's a statement that he lived from the beginning of the captivity of the Jews until Cyrus came in and continued into the reign of the Medo-Persians. So this passage is also to prepare us for the grand prophecy of the 70 weeks in chapter 9, which takes place in or around the first year of Cyrus, the date when the Jewish captivity ends. And so it is not a statement saying that Daniel died in the first year of Cyrus, because we know in chapter 10, verse 1, that he was still around in the third year of Cyrus. It's simply to indicate that he existed through the whole captivity and into the time of the Medo-Persians. Chapter 2. You do not have any questions on chapter 2 yet, because we're not going to get anywhere close to being finished with chapter 2 this week. We're actually going to try to do it this week and next and be done with it in 2 weeks, but I make no promises. Although, the third week, after this week, next week, someone else will be teaching, because I'll be at Polishing the Pulpit, and so whoever else will be teaching will get to go into chapter 3, and if we have to finish up chapter 2's material later, we will. Okay, chapter 2, verse 1. Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Chapter 2 is foundational to the understanding of the rest of the apocalyptic sections. It covers history from Babylon to Rome. Chapter 2 is expanded on by chapter 7, especially in regard to the second and third kingdoms. It is expanded on by chapters 11 and 12, especially in regard to kingdoms 2, 3, and 4. So, while chapter 2 in the historical section stands alone, it is a single event, there are at least three other chapters in the rest of the book that are going to refer back to this dream and the context here found. So, Daniel is one of those books that you can't just, okay, well, I'm in chapter 4 now, I can forget everything that's happened prior to it. You've got to keep the context in, which is fairly easy to do, because at the beginning of each vision it tells you when the vision occurred. And so you're able to draw back to the historical section to understand more fully what's going on. This chapter spells out the fact that the Davidic kingdom has not been violated. The Gentiles do rule Israel, but the day will come, teaches this chapter, when under the Messiah the kingdom would be restored to the saints. The kingdom of chapter 2, verse 44, is the Messianic kingdom. All right, so an outline of chapter 2. Chapter 2, verses 1 through 13, we have the forgotten dream and the deadly decree. That's verses 1 through 13, the forgotten dream and the deadly decree. Chapter 2, verses 14 through 24, we have the proposition, prayer, and revelation. Verse 14 through 24, the proposition, prayer, and revelation. Then verses 25 through 30, we have the standing before royalty. Verses 25 through 30, standing before royalty. Verse 31 through 45, the dream revealed and unraveled. Verse 31 through 45, the dream revealed and unraveled. And then verse 46 through 49, the promotion of the saints. Verse 46 through 49, the promotion of the saints. All right, into verse 1. Here in verse 1, you have the mightiest individual on the face of the earth, this point in time, by way of power over the largest amount of any single nation, the most powerful nation of the earth, and he is troubled by dreams. Now just think, if God can use something as insubstantial as dreams to trouble the mightiest man on the planet, imagine what he could do with armies. God can use the smallest of things to cause a great deal of destruction in people's lives. And that is exactly what he will do for Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 2, then the king came to command, or gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. Notice, each one of us at some point in our lives make choices that end up being a complete waste of time. This was one of Nebuchadnezzar's instances of that. He's going to call them and be completely dissatisfied. Now, just by way of kind of some definition to these four groups, magicians, and this is according to Rex Turner's commentary on Daniel, magicians, in general, magicians had some crude knowledge of the law of nature, which was not accessible to the people in general. You can think to in the book of Exodus, when the magicians of Pharaoh were there, and some of the things that Moses and Aaron did, they could replicate. Aaron threw his rod down and became a snake. They replicated it. They turned water into blood. So they had means whereby they could attempt to do the same thing. But as soon as God turned the dust into lice, it was out of their league, and they said, "This is the hand of God." So they could utilize nature to give the appearance of doing that which was miraculous. And that was what magicians were known for doing, as they still are today, using natural means to perform that which appears to be impossible. Okay? That's the sense of the magicians. The enchanters sought to influence others by charms and other such mediums. They demonstrated their powers through the means of charming snakes, fowls, and other animals. Deuteronomy 18, verses 9 through 11 deals with that some. Sorcerers made a practice of consulting the mysterious, whether animal, human, divine, or divine, in order to determine a future course of action. So sorcerers are primarily dealing with how do you determine what's in the future based upon these other things. And then Chaldeans, which were considered in Babylon's day at this time to kind of be the top tier of the wise men and these special individuals, consisted of those who had learning in the fields of astronomy, mathematics, and the associated theories of astrology and divination. Now, of course, all four of these, in their function and their totality, are condemned, Old Testament and New. Okay? It is such that while they proclaimed to be these things, they were such falsely, and God said these practices were wrong. Okay? But
the Babylonians referred to as the Chaldeans?
Yes. That's something else I should mention. Chaldeans, in that reference, it has two different meanings, historically and biblically. One is an ethnic meaning, that is, the people from the land of Chaldea, as well as it had a reference to the specific magicians or astrologers who were known as Chaldeans. Okay, so you have to let the context dictate which one's being talked about. In this context, he's talking about the astrologers. He's talking about those wise men of the Chaldeans. Okay, so there's two different uses there, and there are even two different uses inside of the book of Daniel. And you see the difference between those. Verses 3 through 11, we have the mystified magi. The king said to them, I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream. The idea there of to know is to understand the dream. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation. So Nebuchadnezzar comes to them, and some argue Nebuchadnezzar knew what the dream was and just wouldn't tell them to test them to find out if they could actually do what they claimed. Some commentators argue he didn't know the dream, same way that Pharaoh didn't know the dream when he came or when Joseph came before him, and therefore couldn't tell them even if he had wanted to. I don't think the text really is clear enough. Some would suggest that a statement made later would indicate that he didn't know it, but others say, no, that deals with something entirely different. So, whether he knew the dream and wouldn't tell them, or didn't know the dream and therefore couldn't tell them, we're not sure. The effect, though, is that he's going to come to the, or he's going to have them come before him and say, listen, you tell me the dream and you tell me the interpretation. For certainly, if you can know the interpretation, you should be able to know what the dream is. You should be able to have just as much ability to divine the dream as to divine the meaning of the dream. And that's his expectations for them. Now, his spirit was anxious. The effect of the dream upon Nebuchadnezzar was exactly what God intended for it to be. He could not rest and did not rest until he found out what this meant. And that was as God intended. Now, the Chaldeans will speak back to him. The indication is they seem to be somewhat the highest tier of the Magi. They seem to be the ones who are in the greatest level of importance, and so therefore they are the ones who are going to respond. But they respond to him in Aramaic, or I think some translations say Syrian. All of the area around Babylon was land that was referenced as the land of the Syrians, and their language is the same general language as that of the Syrians. You may even remember all the way back to Abraham. Abraham's family is referenced as Syrians, and they're from Aram. And they are Aramaeans. So, when you notice the connection of all of these things, Aramaic is from the same base language, and it is very possible that there is some actual connection, ascendant, descendant-wise, of Abraham's family and some portion of the Babylonians. So, just some interesting thing to consider. But it's also interesting to point out that this dream, as we go into it later on and understand what's being talked about, here is a dream that is going to deal with history of God's people and God's kingdom and the kingdoms of the earth from 600 BC, 586 BC, all the way forward to the time of the coming of Christ and the coming of the church and the coming of the kingdom. That being said, this dream isn't given to one of the major prophets. Isn't given to Isaiah. Isn't given to Jeremiah. Isn't given to a king of Israel. It's given to a heathen king. Think about that. It's going to be interpreted by an individual who's not even known as a prophet yet. It's just interesting to consider that God doesn't always use what we would consider as the best means or the easiest way to achieve his goal. Sometimes he has knowledge and wisdom. I believe 1 Corinthians points out that the wisdom of God is foolishness with men. The foolishness of God is greater than the wisdom of men. God gives this dream not to the Jews, but to Babylon. It's to Nebuchadnezzar.
It's interesting because he also sent heal them who was not his covenant people, and he also the widow.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were from Syria, were they
mm-hmm.
not?
Yep.
Does like he
believes, yes, he does. Yes, he does. All right. So in verse 4, the Chaldeans respond, O king. Oh, by the way, I should mention this before we proceed. From this statement, O king, live forever, in chapter 2, verse 4, through chapter 7, verse 28, the book is written in Aramaic. It is no longer written in Hebrew. From chapter 1 through the first part of chapter 2, verse 4, it's written in Hebrew. From chapter 4, midway through, the beginning of their statement, till chapter 7, verse 28, it's written in Aramaic. And then it switches back for the remainder of the book to Hebrew. In a section of the book of Ezra, similar thing. When it deals with issues of the court, at that point, the court of the Medo-Persians, this point, the court of Babylon, it changes languages. As a matter of fact, we know that and showed to be continually written down or scribed that way because the copy of the Book of Daniel that we have from the Dead Sea Scroll find is written exactly like that. It is Hebrew until chapter 2, verse 4, Aramaic till chapter 7, verse 28, and then Hebrew again. And so it's consistently through that, and the indication from that is because it was written for the Jews in captivity, not necessarily for the Jews in Jerusalem. And so therefore would have been an explanation of these things and would have used the language of the court to do that. So, their statement there in verse 4, finally getting to it, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream and we will give the interpretation. Now he's just told them the exact opposite. You tell me the dream, you tell me the interpretation, and their response is somewhat belittling and defensive. No, king, it's not the way it works. You tell us the dream and we'll tell you the interpretation. Verse 5, the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces and your houses shall be made an ash heap. I believe the King James says, the thing is gone from me. I like the way the New King James translates it. Homer Haley in his commentary says this, the thing, literally the word, is gone from me. That is the word demanding that they tell the meaning of the dream and the interpretation. He tested their ability to tell the meaning of by their ability to tell him the dream also. So he's not saying, the thing's gone from my mind, I can't tell you what it means, or I can't tell you the dream. He's saying, my commandment went out my mouth and it's going to stay the way it is. Okay? I told you, you tell me the dream, now you tell me the dream. That's the meaning of that statement, the thing is gone from me. McGuigan says, one thing is certain, he knew the wise men were beyond making up an interpretation if they had one. He also knew if the magicians could tell him the dream without it being told them, they would be demonstrating their ability to interpret it. So, the logic is, if you can tell me the dream, clearly I can believe the interpretation. If you can't tell me the dream, how do I know you're not making up the interpretation? How do I know you're not being a fraud in this? They answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream and we will give its interpretation. The king answered and said, I know for certain that you would gain time because you see that my decision is firm. Now, the conclusion could be drawn by Nebuchadnezzar, well, they're just stalling. Though he couldn't actually know that by knowing their minds, now could he? We do that sometimes, don't we? You're just stalling for time. Now, sometimes, based upon the actions of an individual, that may be a justified conclusion, but we can't always know that that's actually true. Nebuchadnezzar, though, happens to be king, and he says, you're just stalling for time, and my decision is firm. I'm not going to change my mind. I'm not going to give you an opportunity to just create some kind of interpretation out of this. Instead, you must give me an answer. If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation. I'm getting ahead of myself. Verse 10, Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such a thing of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. While their statement is true, who at one time asked very much such a thing? Pharaoh. In Exodus, he asked for his wise men to give him the dream and the interpretation, and yet they could not. But their statement here is, king, you're not playing by the rules. It's not how this works. They spoke more truth than they knew, for they are witnesses that astrology and the like are fraudulent. The mumblings and waverings of the fortune tellers are all too familiar. If these people have any power at all, why must they have their crystal balls? Why can't they perform with an onion or a wiener? You know? What's so special about a crystal ball? And if the crystal ball is the thing with the power, why not bypass the fortune teller and go straight to the manufacturing plant and get the crystal ball there? So, they testify that they are fraud. No king or ruler has asked such things. Nebuchadnezzar is being told that he isn't fair. He's not playing the game by the usual rules. Was ever a lying system better exposed than by this sort of speech? Let them be witnesses against themselves, McGuigan says. And so they try to say, well, you give us the dream, we'll give you the interpretation. No man can do this. Notice what they say, verse 11. It is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Now that part they had right. Said, you're kind of asking for something humans can't do here, Nebuchadnezzar. Well, the problem, though, was this is part of what they claimed to be able to do. This is part of what they should have been able to do. If they could do all that they claimed, if they had the power that they ascribed to themselves, but they didn't. And so they will seek to shove it off and say, well, this is only something the gods can do, which is exactly true. It was left up to God in the end to do so. Verses 12 through 13, we have the doomed diviners. For this reason, the king was angry and very furious and gave the command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Indication is that he ordered a public execution of the wise men, and that the text kind of reads as such that they just killed them as they came to them. But indication more likely is that they began rounding them up to kill them and do it all at once in a public display. No, you got the wrong guy. It is interesting, though, that we will see a similar fit of anger from Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 3. Although this time, not toward the wise men, but toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. Exactly. So, verse 14 through 24, we have, as we mentioned before, the proposition, prayer, and revelation. Daniel's offer, chapter 2, verses 14 through 16. Then the counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree from the king so urgent? When Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. It's not real clear, based upon the workings of the court and Daniel's position at this time, if he actually physically went in before Nebuchadnezzar to request the time, or if through Arioch, the captain's or the king's captain, that was done. But either way, the request was made to the king, hold the killing, put a stay on the order, I'll get you the interpretation. I will make known to the king the interpretation. Verse 17 through verse 18, we have Daniel's prayer for help. Then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So they will go before God, and they will request that the vision be made known to them, and they seek mercies. It seems Daniel appears, they didn't get out the books of astrology or wizardry. They provoked one another to prayer to the God of heaven. There is no doubt about this being more effective than peering into an ox's liver, or mumbling over a glass ball, or worry. Don't we do that sometimes? Got something coming up or difficult in front of us, and instead of praying, we just worry about it? Such is not the example of Daniel, Hananiah, Azariah, Mishael. Daniel had already told the king he would deliver the message, and so he and his friends are going to God in confidence and utter dependence. Concerning the secret, the word secret occurs 9 times in this chapter, and such might be the reason why in Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 3, Daniel is described as one who knew secrets. And he is, that secrets were not hidden from him. God's response, verse 19, then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision, so Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Now, Haley says concerning this, one may see a vision while awake or asleep. The word occurs so often in the book of Daniel, 22 times in the singular, 10 times in the plural, that it must be defined. The word means the word places the emphasis and primacy on those dimensions which are extra physical, something seen other than by ordinary sight, a visual sight without corporal presence. And so the idea is seeing something that one could not see naturally is that which is a vision. It could be in the daytime, could be in the nighttime, it could be awake or asleep. The indication is when John is on the island of Patmos in the book of Revelation, he sees a vision, but he's not asleep at the time. And yet we know there are other times, for instance, Jacob will, as he's traveling to the family of his mother, will fall asleep there with his head on the stone, and will see a vision, a dream. And such will happen while he's asleep. So visions could be nighttime, daytime, sleep, awake. The word doesn't dictate it, the context does. But again, the term for vision is used 32 times in the book of Daniel. That ought to tell you something about what's found in the book of Daniel. All right, we'll pick up in verse 20 next week.